As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Living Writers Show on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. My name is Ashley David. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. My guest is Keith Taylor, author of 6 collections of poetry, 1 collection of short stories, and translator of What These Ithacas Mean, Readings in Kavafi with Artemis Leontis and Lauren Talali. Co-editor of that book. He's also the co-editor and translator of the forthcoming book of translations, Battered Guitars, Poetry and Prose of Kostas Kariotakis, and that's along with William Reeder. In 2000, along with John Knott, who's here in the English department, Keith Taylor co-edited the anthology The Huron River, Voices from the Watershed, which was the finalist in 2001 for the Great Lakes Book Award for General Nonfiction, recipient of NEA Poetry Fellowships, fiction grants from the ArtServe Michigan, the Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affairs, for poetry and prose. Taylor is also noted for his work in public radio. In 2001, he co-hosted a 13-week radio program, Storylines, America, Midwestern Literature, and that was broadcast by national public radio stations in 8 states in the Midwestern region, and it received the best award in special programming for the Michigan Association of Broadcasters. Beloved by his students, Keith Taylor is the writer-in-residence at Green Hills Private School, and also teaches part-time at the University of Michigan, where he coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing. We'll be talking predominantly today about his newest book out from Hanging Loose Press. It's called Guilty at the Rapture. Welcome, Keith. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Ashley.
So we've got lots to talk about today, and we'll jump right in.
Good. But
I'd like to start first with a bit of reading from your new book, from Guilty at the Rapture. Would you read a poem for us?
Sure, happy to. Which one do you want?
How about the one on page 16?
All right. This is a poem. This is an old poem, actually. The title's changed and the stanza's been dropped, but I resurrected it for this book. Confusion of Wonders. This is actually a poem about it ends with a reoccurring dream that I had in my childhood. My sister and I shared a room, and my bed would lift up at night, dive down toward my sister, and then head out through the window. It's also filled, of course, with my very religious upbringing, which we can talk about more if you care to. So the poem is called A Confusion of Wonders. After harvest in Alberta, we children of the hard God were never certain of our sins. We found ways to pass, but not forget, the endless list of forbidden joys that governed our waking. When the CBC showed westerns, we went next door to watch John Wayne almost win the very land we lived on. But it was hard, I tell you. Our words blurred. Calgary. Calvary. Cavalry. And our beds, lifted at moonrise, pushed through the window, took off like magic flying mattresses over cows, over wheat fields, over horses, plunging up a low hill we wanted to name Golgotha.
Thank you. That's a poem from Keith Taylor's newest book, Guilty at the Rapture, just out, hot off the presses.
Hot off the press. The ink is still wet.
Still drying. Right. And, so let's do start with the beginning. You were a child of the Canadian Plains. You grew up in Alberta?
I grew up in Alberta. I am the grandson of pioneers. All 4 sets of my grandparents were homesteaders in Alberta around the turn of the last century.
And you wrote about them recently. You co-edited the documentary Imagination Special Issue of the Michigan Quarterly Review, and I believe wrote about...
I did. I wrote about my great-grandma, my Irish immigrant great-grandmother who committed suicide in Alberta 3 years after her immigration, but that's another story.
And a surprise to you.
A surprise to me, yes. Yeah. No. Well, we'll tell that story. The quick version of that story is that in 1996, in a very obscure book, the title of which is Pioneer Policing in Southern Alberta, Dean of the Mounties, 1880 to 1914, which I found on the sale table at Chamon Drum Bookshop on State Street here in Ann Arbor. I found the police report of my great-grandmother's suicide, which came as a shock to me. They had hidden the story in my grandparents' generation. The police report ended with a transcription of her suicide note, which was addressed to her older children, one of whom was my grandfather. And it starts out, "Your father told me to leave the place this morning if I would not sleep with him. I love my children. God knows I love my children. I don't want any more children." So she went out to the outhouse and drank a jar of acid.
Oh, heavens.
So I found that, which made me just about faint. I don't usually faint. I'm good around blood and life-threatening situations, but I just about fainted when I found that. And I've been working ever since then on trying to find the details of her life, which are difficult to find. We all know that the history of poor women is the history that is usually lost. And I have this little window into the life of this particular poor woman because of that discovery and because of the family documents and everything else. So I've been working on that, and that's a lot of fun. One of the reasons I recognized it is that I had written poems about those people and I dug up some things, so I knew those names and knew a little bit about the life. So I'm probably the only one of my second cousins who would have recognized that as our people. Because the name was spelled wrong, and the place name had changed. The place name had changed in 1909. So none of us knew that little rural area was called Kansas. We always knew it as Westcott. So I recognized the incidents of the story, which was a wonderful discovery. Happened because I write poems.
Well, you write poems now in more recent history, so you grew up there on the plains, and your dad, you're the son of a preacher.
I am the son of a preacher man, yep, the only boy who could ever teach me. Those people converted, some of them converted to a particular sect of Mennonism, which is the way I describe Mennonites to people who aren't up on those things, and Mennonites are Amish with cars. So we were... from a world-denying sect. I didn't have TV when I grew up. It was a sin to go to the movies. It was a sin to dance. It was a sin to play cards. Smoking and drinking, of course, were several steps down the stairway to hell. So that poem, the endless list of forbidden joys that governed our waking, that was it. Basically, anything that was any fun was a sin. It's not quite true, of course, but we still could laugh occasionally about cattle and farming.
Austerity and work.
Yes, austerity and work, particularly agricultural work. Yes, if you were a farmer, your chances of going to heaven were considerably better.
Well, now growing up in that environment, then being a farmer seems to have direct usefulness. How did you become a poet?
Because I was because I rebelled against that background. My family, I mean that. Religious group has changed a lot over the years, and if you were to look at them now, they just basically look like Republican evangelicals, even though they're not, even though some of them don't even know that they're not, but they're not. So we had changed, and I had to rebel against that, and I did. I defined myself. Once I was bitten by the book bug and the poetry bug, which happened in adolescence, we also moved from Western Canada in adolescence. We moved from Western Canada. My family moved temporarily to South Bend, Indiana. I didn't fit in. It was the late 60s. It was a time not to fit in, when not fitting in had a certain cultural cachet, which, of course, played to all my worst instincts. So I ended up defining myself against that, and I've slowly, over the 35 years since then, been growing back into it.
And you've told me a story now about there was one thing that your father heard or read that he was very proud of.
Well, it was interesting. Yeah, my dad and I get along pretty well. We've made a decision over the years that we don't talk about certain things. We don't talk about abortion. We don't talk about evolution. We don't talk about gay people. We just are not going to have those discussions because we know we're not going to agree and we're going to yell at each other. But he's kept up with what I write, and when I've had work, you know, like book reviews in the Los Angeles Times or something that he sees out on the West Coast, he's pleased to see that, and he lets me know that he's pleased. But when I did radio, interestingly, in 2001, I did radio, and this was decidedly Midwestern stuff, and they live in just outside Portland, Oregon, and he tuned in online. I was 49 years old. He tuned, and he called me up. And he said, for the first time in my life, I don't think he realizes this was the first time in my life, but he said, "I'm proud of you." And you know, I got all teary, got all choked up, and I was going to, you know, but I didn't want to make a point like saying, "I have to get to be 49 years old before you tell me you're proud of me." I knew that he was proud of me before that, but that was the first time, I believe, in my life he ever said it.
Wow, what a nice treat.
It was a treat, yeah. You know, I'm glad we both survived long enough.
Indeed. Well, you were bitten by the poetry bug then as a sort of coming-of-age person in South Bend, Indiana in the 60s.
I was, yeah. No.
Was there a particular body of work or person or book that did it for you?
Early in those years, no. I mean, I had even before that, I'd memorized poetry. We always had to memorize the Bible, King James Version. We did a lot of that. And that started early, even before I could read. I was memorizing the Bible. And that translated very early on in my life. I mean, 7, 8 years old, I was memorizing poetry. I mean, at one point in my life, like 7 years old, I could do all of Robert Service's The Cremation of Sam McGee.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, there's strange things done by the midnight sun, by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic tales have their trails, have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold.
And the first time I've been warm, that's the one.
And yes, it's since I left Plum Tree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm. That's the one. So, you know, some of that was whatever those rhythms were and whatever that joy and that kind of narration that had hit me early on. In South Bend, it was the first winter I was there. It was seventh grade, I believe. Sometimes I say this is the only thing I will ever write in my life without ulterior motives, without sort of saying, I'm writing a poem now, or I'm writing a story, or I'm writing something. I looked out my window at snow and wrote something about the snow. And I took it to school and showed it to a guy who later became a drug dealer.
Your first editor.
That's right. And he said, make it a poem. And I said, well, what do I do then? He said, well, just make it, you know, break up the lines, make it look funny. You know, he didn't say lines even, he just said, break it up, make it look funny. So I did, my English teacher went nuts, and ever since then I was a poet. The English teacher even gave it its title, lousy title, called The Passion of Winter. I still have a copy.
I wish I'd known that. I would have asked you to bring it.
It's pretty awful.
Can you recite it?
No, I can't recite it. But it was decidedly just looking out my window describing a snowstorm.
Now, this was not the first time you'd seen snow. You came from the plains of Alberta.
Yeah.
What was it about the snow in South Bend that
struck you? You know, because I came from the plains of Alberta, I think, you know, winter is our season. Margaret Atwood writes about that a lot, actually. For Canadians, winter is our season. And we imagine things when they're cold, when there is no bird song, when people will die if they go out without protection. So I still am. I mean, winter is my season. I love it.
Great. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about this newest book, Guilty at the Rapture.
Sure.
In it, there are both prose and poetry pieces. And your collection of stories, Life Science and Other Stories, I'm told at one point was Life Science and Other Poems. I want to talk about genre. Some things you can look at the page and we can say, well, we've broken it up, those lines look funny, this is definitely a poem.
Right.
But how do you think about your work in terms of genre, and when is it, your criticism is clearly prose, but then there's this whole other spectrum.
Right. I think that that's an important question. I know that question has helped me as a writer. There are other writers who do things, you know, sometimes in line and sometimes in paragraph, and they say, well, it's what I call it. That's all that matters. But no, I mean, thinking about that question has been good for me. It has helped me write. Certainly, there are things that come out rhythmically that seem to have patterns of repetition, of sound or of emphasis, and those I will often try to accent by line. Sometimes quite artificially. Now I will tell you this, you can't tell anybody though, that I often
mom's the word.
I often count syllables. If you look through, there's a lot of poems in this book that you will find every line of that poem has 7 syllables. How did that happen?
Not a coincidence.
Not a coincidence. So, you know, I mean, I that kind of order that will come with that. When I do, a lot of my poems tell stories anyway, which is another unfashionable thing about my poems, which we could talk about too if you wanted to. But there's a narrative element in a lot of things that I write. Sometimes when I'm doing that, the narrative seems very clear that it's going to move from paragraph to paragraph to paragraph, and it does seem more like a story. It has a beginning. It has the famous arc, the narrative arc, although it's not a word I particularly like. But so those things will end up being stories. And also there are things in this book that I consider tiny little essays. I mean, there's no fiction in them. There is in the other book, too, Life Science and Other Stories.
Well, and none of these books are labeled as anything in particular.
No,
they're titled, but they are not titled. Labeled as fiction. So it's all, I mean, yep. I have one of the stories in the book, which is fiction, is about being in Paris and stealing this man's money. And I'm reading it, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, Keith, you thief. What kind of Mennonite are you?
It looks like such a nice boy.
Yeah,
and people have asked me about that a lot. It's interesting about doing that, about putting these things together, because you have that lyric voice, that I in the first person in a poem, which we all assume, because of the Romantics and because of the last 200 years, that is indeed the poet. And that's fun to play against. And so I put these things where the I is very obviously me. And in my own mind, it's me. And I put that next to something where the I is very obviously not me. And, you know, it's fun to see what happens, because suddenly it's like what's the guy who wrote the James Fry, who had the big scandal on Oprah?
Is it true?
I suddenly look much worse than I am, except, of course, when anybody ever asks me. I don't claim that it's true. But in the Life Science book, for instance, there's a story called The Customer, which is about the guy doesn't do anything, but he follows a woman through a town, very much like Ann Arbor. And it's fiction. You know, I never did that, even though it's in the first person. Believe me, actually, I never did that.
I believe you.
Okay, thank you. Well, that story was read on NPR's Selected Shorts. It was read by the actor Jeffrey Wright, who's just got this incredible voice, and he did such a wonderful job. And I was so proud of that, as I still am. And I had my sister, who's a nurse in Portland, Oregon, listen to it while she was working, and she brought all her nurse friends over and said, "My brother's story is going to be on NPR." And so the little sick babies were all asleep, and so these nurses in Oregon gathered around to listen to that story, and it's about this rather creepy guy following women through a town. So they all sort of looked, and she called me up that night. She says, "Why did you tell me that story? It was so creepy." And I went, "Well, story, it's fiction. It's not me." But so the blur, even my own sister. My
Even your own sister sibling. Falls for it. Yeah. That's the convincing heart to these stories. And
but
poems.
It's fun. It's fun to do, and it's a good thing to do. I think as a reader, I enjoy that kind of thing, because I don't know how to label point of view, and that's kind of fun.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Living Writer Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor 88.3. My name is Ashley David. My guest today is Keith Taylor. We'll be right back.
Just want to thank you for all of the things you've done. I've been thinking about you, I just want to send my love. I send my best to you, that's my message of love.
Good afternoon, you're listening to The Living Writers Show. My guest today is Keith Taylor. I'm Ashley David. Thanks for joining us. We are talking about lots of things, and we're sort of focusing on his newest book, Guilty at the Rapture, just out from Hanging Loose Press. And Keith, I wonder if you'd read another little bit for us.
I'd be happy
from
to.
That. How about Cracks of Dawn?
Okay, that's later, isn't it? Yes.
Page 64.
There we go. Thank you.
Or sorry, Crack of Dawn.
Crack of Dawn, yeah. Another little older poem that I resurrected for this book. It seemed to fit because it was about them looking out in my wonderful backyard, saying this is when people were killed. This was execution time, which is how the poem begins. So, Crack of Dawn. Execution time. The red slash cut between oaks, the line across snow. One cigarette, a final cup of coffee. It will end in rapture or holocaust at this hour, when the world shrinks beneath the day's weight, under the lies about light behind an opening door, about beginning, about birdsong.
Thank you very much. Now, it was a little slip for me to call that Cracks of Dawn, but I think I'm going to make it work.
Yeah.
You have been described, this book has been described, rather, as sort of going toward the apocalypse, no matter what.
Right.
And so I'm going to crack, you know, dawn open and all kinds of things. And let's talk about falling off the face of the earth.
Yeah, well, this book, as it took shape, which it took this shape with significant help from my editors out in Brooklyn, and as I started seeing this stuff, the shape of these things, all these different kinds of end of the world scenarios were coming into play, or sometimes they were just ends of small worlds.
For that subjective eye, who has the eye,
exactly.
It's like the end of my world.
Right. And so then this poem seemed to fit suddenly. It had been in a chapbook years ago, but you know, what that was. I mean, it was, that was very self-revelatory because I, you know, I mean, I look like Santa Claus, and sometimes I kind of imagine.
It's true, that. Listeners. He does have a little resemblance to Santa Claus. Sometimes you imagine yourself as Santa Claus.
Well, you know, I'm a pretty jovial kind of guy. And not only that, I'm fairly hopeful, even though I have trouble with the religious hope I grew up with. I have certain amounts of hope about our possibilities. And this book, because of this theme that was there that I hadn't even quite realized, ends up being at least a tad darker than my self-image. But that's a fair amount of work. That, you know, I mean, that's, you know, 80 pages of stuff.
80 pages of apocalypse.
Exactly.
And it's not really. I don't want to overdraw the.
Hopefully, there's still yeah. a couple laughs in there. And that was that became pretty interesting to me, just as much as for what I could find out about myself, and what I'd done. I mean, this work covers. I mean, it's really 20 years of work in this book, and you know, that this theme has been there from 1985 to 2005 is interesting.
Now, as you are reworking this book, I've heard you say that some of the poems that are not included in some of the writing that has dropped out of this collection has been your work that has to do with birds and nature and some of the more, which you're an avid birder.
The hopeful stuff. Yeah.
Now, is that stuff hopeful or?
By and large, it is. You know, I mean, despite the fragility of birds and despite the fragility of the natural world, I still have great hope in its resiliency that we can find ways not to screw it up or find ways to restore it, in the pattern of Aldo Leopold or somebody. A lot of that does tend to appear to be more purely observation, that we look at the world and the act of looking is in and of itself enough. And I do agree with that. I do think that's a philosophical position that I subscribe to.
Is it one that you sort of wove into your editorial decisions for the documentary Imagination Issue of the Michigan Quarterly?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, my interest in documentary, in the broadest definition of it, is certainly that we can find these things in the world, and they can assume their own meaning, and that can be interesting. Yeah, but I have a whole other book. I mean, I don't think my friends at Hanging Loose will publish this book. My Midwestern bird poems don't appeal to their big city sensibilities.
In Brooklyn.
But there'll be another book that will come from somebody, probably somebody regional, that will be much more focused on environmental things and looking at those birds. But it's an important thing to me. It gets me off. I'm a sedentary guy, you know. I read and I write, and I need to get outdoors.
Well, you recently told me a story about trekking all the way down to the south of Texas to see whooping cranes.
I did. I got a little bit of money from the university to pay some of my expenses to a writers' conference in Austin. And I don't go, even though I'm a director of one writers' conference, but I don't go to many of them because I feel kind of uncomfortable in many of them. So I went down to this big AWP conference, which for those people who don't know is the sort of big national conference for writers who have jobs in universities. And I felt I had to do what I had to do to earn my money. I gave myself, if I talk to 25 people, I can leave. And I checked them all off.
Did
and
you
I
count?
To, you did. I did. I had
did
a
you count
list.
Me twice?
No, because I didn't talk to you.
That's
I just,
true. We didn't
just,
run into
you
know, each other.
No, I didn't run into you. But I got to my 25, and then I went down to Aransas National Wildlife Refuge, which is where whooping cranes, which nest in my home province, which nest in northern Alberta. But that wild flock that has survived all winters in Aransas on the Texas coast, and I'd never seen a whooping crane, and I wanted to see one. And there are 400 on Earth, and I saw 25 of them on the Monday after the AWP conference. At one point on the Monday afternoon, I was in this little boat with a dozen people, and we were in the middle of a 50-square-mile saltwater swamp. And we were about 50 yards from a family of three whooping cranes, had a spotting scope on it, our largest North American bird, one of the rarest birds on Earth. And I actually saw a drop of water form and then glisten and fall off the beak of this incredibly beautiful rare bird. And to me, that's just wonderfully, that's a moving moment. And I've even tried to write a poem about that drop of water, but it hasn't succeeded yet. Because as you can tell,
still in the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm still in the moment, and it would be real easy to make that pretty hokey. So
you could write a little jingle.
I could. No, we won't try to do that.
No, let's not do that now. Well, I want to talk a little bit about fashion, but before we lose it, I want to mention, I did not mention in the introduction, about Bear River. You're the director of the Bear River Writers Conference.
I have taken over. Our friend Richard Tillinghast retired, and I have taken over as the director of the Bear River Writers Conference, which is associated with the English Department at the university. It meets up at Camp Michigania on Walloon Lake the first week in June every year. We do workshops with about 9 writers and then have a guest writer, guest artist who talks about things. The guest artist this year is the novelist Brett Lott, also the editor of the Southern Review, a place many writers want to publish.
Yeah.
So they can Google us on the University of Michigan site. Just Google Bear River and you'll find us.
Find you. Well, let's talk about fashion.
Literary fashion.
Okay. I mean, we can talk about clothes. I've been shopping lately. I know that's your favorite.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You said that this book, your editors wanted the sort of nature poems or the more observatory poems out of this collection.
There's still some nature poems in there, but yeah, they wanted that out. There's that.
But that's an editorial decision. And earlier in the interview, you mentioned that a lot of your poems tell stories when we were talking about genre bending, and that's not terribly fashionable right now. And I wonder if you would talk, we're going to talk sort of more at length in the final segment of the show about poetry worlds, but if you could sort of mention what, or sort of expand upon what you meant by fashion and fashionable and poetry, which it seems like an oxymoron anyway to talk about poetry.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the tempests in our particular teapot, which can be, you know, strange and bitter and sometimes even more bitter than more important tempests and more important in larger teapots. But there was a reaction in the 1990s and continues with people who are doing MFAs now against what had been a kind of plain-spoken direct poetry that grew out of the poetry that was all done around the Vietnam War. And a lot of that poetry told stories, and a lot of that poetry told stories about the lives of the poet who would write the poem. So there was an understandable reaction against that that complicated the surface of the poems, that had a lot more wordplay, that played a lot with diction and syntax and made the surface of the poems much more complex. And the poems themselves became much more focused on the language of their composition. And there was a group that even called themselves language poets, but not just them. I mean, other poets associated with different groups had that same kind of thing. This is all pretty understandable. I think in some ways it's gone a little overboard. Mark Doty had a wonderful line that I use in this discussion in a book of his prose. And he said what he and his friend Linda Hull, who died tragically young, he said what they were interested in most in poetry was ornate surfaces over edgy material. And I think that summed up much of what was going on in the 90s. I think much of what has been lost is the second part of that statement, though. Ornate surfaces, and we've lost the edgy material. So we have a poetry right now in the ascendancy that has very interesting, complex surfaces. And sometimes I feel it's not over a lot of substance. That's the generous side of it. My ungenerous take, which does come out from time to time, is that these are just a bunch of poets who all they've ever done is go to school,
That's what they're going to write about.
They have no personal narratives to tell. So when they don't, well, let's foreground something else then. That's the ungenerous side, which I feel less than half the time, but I do feel it from time to time. Yeah,
That
the old macho thing that you used to see in books all the time, where you know all writers. Had to go out and do all these macho things. It was silly, of course, and it was posturing. But the fact that now that, you know, even my own blurb, you know, it just sort of says where you teach and what awards you've won and where you went to school.
And my introduction was all of that,
exactly.
Too.
Exactly. You know, I mean, in some ways, that is a diminishment. It's like, oh, writers don't have to be interesting anymore because they're writers after all. They make it all up. They don't have to live it. So, you know, some of this is worth reacting against, even though, you know, it has to be somebody who's 25, not somebody who's 53, who makes those reactions, I think. But it'll happen.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to return and talk about being interesting and having a life and those the different poetry worlds. You are tuned in to The Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name is Ashley David. My guest today is Keith Taylor. We'll be right back after our break.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Living Writer Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor 88.3. My name is Ashley David. My guest today is Keith Taylor. We're talking about many things, the centerpiece of which is his newest book out from Hanging Loose Press. It's called Guilty at the Rapture. And the music we've been listening to today are all picks from Mr. Taylor. We started out today with some Alison Krauss, a little gospel from Alison Krauss, and then some of Neil Young's new album. Yep. All the theme is the prairie.
It is indeed.
And then that was Katie Lang singing a Crosby, Stills, and Nash song written by Neil Young.
Yep. Help Us. Gorgeous song.
Yeah, it takes us back to the Canada Plains.
Right, and she's from a tiny little town called Consort, Alberta, which is just down the road from where my dad grew up. I mean, it is the middle of nowhere.
I heard, maybe this is a bit of sort of urban myth or music myth or whatever, but I heard tell that she believes that she's the reincarnation of Patsy Cline. They both have this amazing 4-octave range.
It is true. She used to have it. I think she's been smoking too many cigarettes. Have you noticed that range seems to be getting narrower?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. That happens. So if you'll start us out this segment by reading a bit of prose from the
sure.
new book.
Happy to. This is a piece about the first poetry reading I ever went to, which happened when I was in high school at the University of Notre Dame. And it was James Dickey, who's probably best known now for writing Deliverance, but this was all before then, when he was considered one of the major poets of the time. The essays were written about James Dickey and Robert Lowell as being the major poets of that time. And it was the first poetry reading I'd ever been to, and it moved me profoundly. So this is part of first reading. I must have already been bitten by the poetry bug, or otherwise I wouldn't have walked the several miles through snow to the auditorium in the library at Notre Dame. I didn't know anyone. I was too young. I wasn't Catholic. I knew nothing yet about the ethics or expectations of poetry readings. I must have already been paying enough attention to the magazines, at least to Time, The Atlantic, and Poetry, to know he was something special, James Dickey. I had already shoplifted his poems 1957 to 1967 and had memorized The Heaven of Animals. Notre Dame was still all male then, but the intense young men were growing their beards, dressing in jeans and ripped shirts, wearing beads and peace signs. Still, I hunkered down in a corner against a wall, hoping not to be noticed, waiting for someone to call me out as a fraud. He's a kid. He's not smart enough. He's too poor. He lives in River Park, for Christ's sake. He's a Protestant. But none of the smart young men, or the professorial types in corduroy sports jackets, or the priests, or even the nuns in the first row seemed to notice. The lights went down, and James Dickey was on stage. He was still blonde in those days, but balding, ruddy, and round-faced, but not puffy like he would look later in the photos taken after his outrageous success with Deliverance. Although no one else did, Dickey laughed often during the introduction, as if he couldn't believe some university type took him so seriously. And it goes on. Really what it was is that James Dickey was drunk. But I had so little experience with drunks that I didn't recognize.
You didn't know that's what it was?
No, I just thought he was weird.
And you say in the piece that you had so little experience with not only drunks, but with poets.
Right.
So you thought that's what being a poet was.
I thought he was wonderful. He read his poem called The Sheep Child. And I just thought he should be arrested. I didn't think people could read things like that in front of other people.
In front of the nuns in particular.
In front of the nuns in particular, yeah. Well, they didn't like it, but...
Well, you go on to say in the piece that you had a conversation with someone at Notre Dame who had been the sponsoring advisor, faculty advisor,
yep,
for that reading,
yep,
who then published one of your poems. And you talked about the reading and discovered that you had very different reactions.
Completely. Well, he was in charge. I mean, this is the poet John Mathias, a wonderful poet. Still teaches at Notre Dame, although I think he's close to retirement now. And he was in charge. He didn't particularly like James Dickey or James Dickey's poetry. I shouldn't put words in his mouth if that I'm not completely sure that's true. But it was the student's choice to have Dickey there, and it would not have been his choice. And Dickey was drunk, and you know, who knows what he was going to do. And he was offending the nuns, and he was being a boor. And that was what John had to deal with. And I'm at my first poetry reading, and I'm just blown away by it. Here's this guy being wacky on stage for, you know, what reason I didn't know. And reading these poems, which I still, even though I see their faults, I still am very moved by James Dickey's poems. So, it was a completely different one of those moments where the subjective changes the objective entirely.
Well, you said in the last segment that you think that perhaps some of what's going on in contemporary poetry is that people have not lived enough of a life in order to bring that to some
only
of
in my
poems.
Ungenerous moments.
Only in your own ungenerous moments. Yes, I don't mean to sort of put you in that box. But one of the things about Dickey was that he really lived quite extravagantly.
He was a soldier. He fought through World War II. He was an outrageously successful advertising executive in Atlanta. Was part of the whole growth of Atlanta as a city of business. And then left all that because he was bitten by the poetry bug. And then, of course, left poetry when he essentially got bitten by being a movie star, by associating with everything that came from Deliverance and the poems he wrote after that. There's a couple that are still pretty interesting, but mostly his life as a poet was over after that enormous success with that movie.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the construction of the poet. I've heard you tell me about sort of you can draw three worlds. There's the academic poetry world. There's the community, like 92nd or St. Mark's poetry in New York and poetry
small
world.
Small press world, yeah.
And then there was a third one.
Commercial.
The commercial is in big publishers.
If they are indeed different worlds, that may be one thing. They are certainly different publishing worlds. The world and the expectation of university presses and the kinds of poetry that are published in university presses and the way they are distributed is one thing. The small presses that are independent of university affiliation is something else entirely. And then, of course, the commercial presses, where poetry plays less and less and less of a role because they can no longer publish books that only sell a couple thousand copies. The demands there are very different entirely. I had one trip back in the 90s when I was pushing the first book that Hanging Loose published, where I went from here, from our little community, which has, which is an academic community, although has other manifestations. And I went to Pittsburgh, and I dealt with some people. I was doing a reading at Carnegie Mellon, talking to the people who were publishing at the University of Pittsburgh Press. And that was all kind of interesting and a little bit scary for me. Then I went to Brooklyn and hung out with these people who do Hanging Loose Press, who they're just so totally filled with enthusiasm. Well,
Robert Hirschhorn, who is the founder of Hanging Loose Press, will be on the show in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, you'll see his incredible enthusiasm, undiminished by the fact that he's 70. And then I went and stayed with a guy who at that time was my agent for selling things that might make a little more money, whose whole life revolved around Random House and HarperCollins and Simon & Schuster. And it was like I was just overwhelmed with this enormous sums of money, none of which were coming my way, by the way, but that he was dealing with and the kinds of pressures that was. And it was it was so completely different. All of them, I think, had interesting parts, but I certainly knew where I was most comfortable. I was certainly most comfortable with the small press people filled with enthusiasm and dead broke.
Now, this is probably a silly question, but take it where you will. Is that personality and sort of where you are, or does that have something to do with fidelity of the work or the kind of work you're doing, or how?
Your generous take on that fidelity to the work and a certain aesthetic principles and things like that would be nice, but I really do think your first take might be the right one. I mean, I really do think some of these differences are probably personality, the way we're hardwired coming into this. We're going to go in certain directions. Of course, our own upbringings are going to play into that. And, the fact that I am most comfortable with small presses that are doing wacky things and are not commercially successful could indeed very well grow out of my Mennonite upbringing, where none of those people ever had any money and they all worked with complete enthusiasm because they were doing it all for God. Some of those relationships seem kind of clear to me. Don't get me wrong, though. One of my books ends up selling 50,000 copies. I'll take it.
A rock star.
I'll take it in a dead minute.
Nothing wrong with them. A little cash in the bank.
I don't want to be too pure.
No. So let's talk a little bit about what's next. This book, Guilty at the Rapture, includes work, some new work, and also work that you've been, over the past 20 years. It's a collection of stuff. What are you working on now?
Well, I have a whole new collection of poems built around different kinds of things, which are kind of interesting. I'm working on some very short poems coupled with prose things in the Japanese style of haibun. There's a nice sampling of that kind of thing in Gary Snyder's last book. called, the book was called Danger on Peaks. So I'm thinking about doing a chapbook of that, dedicating it to a nature writer friend of mine named Jerry Dennis, who lives up north in Traverse City.
You dedicate a lot of your work.
I do, yes, yes. And I used to try to suppress that, and now it's like, I'm not going to do that anymore. Because, I mean, this is, it's done out of a it's done in and out of a community of friends and family. And I know that. And when I'm writing these things, I know what is motivating that. And at least I think I should mention that.
Do you mention it for the friends and family and for yourself, or do you mention it for the readers, or what sort of audience do you imagine, if so?
Certainly for the friends and family, mm-hmm. and certainly for myself. But the simple fact that that other people realize this, even though they would never know the names of most of these people. Now, in this book, for instance, I have an imitation of a Tom Lynch poem, and I do say that. I have an imitation of a Canadian novelist, very well known in Canada, named Robert Croach, who's not very well known in the United States, but I feel like I have to mention his influence on that poem. The rest of them, I mean, there's a poem mentioned, you know, dedicated to a kid named Nicholas Wallace, who was in elementary school with my daughter, used to tease her about sharks. You know, I mean, I don't even know if Nick Wallace is ever going to read this poem, let alone anyone else. But the fact that he's part of the poem and you know, his life in Ann Arbor is intersected with my life, and the fact that my daughter was afraid to swim for a couple of years because of those freshwater sharks that were going to get her. After she saw Jaws, and
Jaws did it for all of us.
I know, yeah. So you know, I mean, that's all important to me, and I like the sense. Now I am completely comfortable with the sense that that I recognize where all of this comes from, and you know, it's if it doesn't interest you, it's easy to overlook it, just not care. A couple of the poems in this book, they're poems that are. In a section called Borrowed Lives, two longish poems in a section called Borrowed Lives, which are in the voice of my wife's late parents. They just told me these stories that seemed too good to give up. Mm-hmm. And so I would tell them in their voice. And that seemed to be recognized too. Plus I knew, as a friend of mine once said, you know a lot of dead people. And, you know, the elegiac thing is important. I mean, it's important to people. It's important to writers. The grief is one of the great motivators for art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love those people who died, so it's important that I recognize them.
Well, in this community in your book seems to me to be a really nice example of the community that is your life. I think of, I mean, the show is called The Living Writers Show, mm-hmm, but I, as I, the more and more I talk to you and I'm familiar with your work, I'm struck by how this seems to be a literary life. And I don't mean that in some exalted ivory tower kind of way. Yeah. I mean, you've managed the Shaman Drum bookstore, mm-hmm, and been a book buyer, and mm-hmm, you've been an editor, and are a teacher, yeah, and a writer, yeah, in multiple genres. And this community of people, both writers and otherwise, is sort of informs a life that lands on the page.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I feel very gifted to have had that life. And, I didn't expect it when I got here. I came here. I don't have a glowing education, a very haphazard education. I was not part of the educational elite, but the town has been good to me, and the place has been good to me, and provided all these options. And I do have a literary life, and I'm kind of pleased by it.
Great. Well, we're going to wrap it up. We've run out of time. I hate to say, but I want to say that you're reading tonight at the Shaman Drum Bookstore.
I am.
It's 7 o'clock.
Yep.
On State, yep, Street. And you're also participating in a conference called Representing the Natural World, which is a tribute to John Knott, who's retiring from the English department. And you'll be introducing Janice Ray.
I will indeed. I look forward to it.
And you co-edited the book, The Huron River Voices from the Watershed, with John Knott, yep, back in 2000. And
that conference is Friday and Saturday.
Friday and Saturday.
And Friday one is in Angel Hall, on the third floor of Angel Hall.
And folks can check the English department at, yeah, the University of Michigan, yeah, website for, yeah, details. So thank you so much, Keith, for joining me today. It's
thank
been
you,
really
Ashley.
Great to have you. And thank you, our listeners, for joining us today. As ever, it's great to have you out there. Next week, Terry Blackhawk will be my guest. Please stay tuned. The sports report is next. And I'd like to thank, in addition to you and my guest, Keith Taylor, I'd like to thank our engineer, Chaz Barrett, for doing a good job, as usual. Stay tuned. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor 88.3. My name is Ashley David, and the sports report is next.